Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Politics Talk podcast. I am your guest host for today, Alex Bogdan. I'm a research director at Ipsos. On this podcast, you often hear Kieran talking about polls and who people are planning on voting for. But in this country, none of us can vote unless we're registered to vote. With that in mind, I have two wonderful guests today, and we will be talking about just that, about registration to vote. So welcome to both of you. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm Phil Thompson. I'm head of research at the Electoral Commission, and the Commission is the body that oversees elections and referendums in the UK and regulates party political finance.
And hi, I'm Ellen Berry, and I'm the head of the UK Democracy Fund, which is a pooled fund. We're independent and nonpartisan, and we're hosted by the Joseph Rowntree Reform Trust, but we have a number of different funders. We're particularly interested in voter registration and participation, and we have a very ambitious goal of getting 1 million low propensity voters registered and voting by the next general election. We don't know when that's going to be, which makes it more exciting. And we're also interested in system reform to make the electoral system, you know, fairer, work better for people as well.
Great. Welcome to both of you. I guess what's prompted us to talk about registration is that the Electoral Commission has very recently published its report on the accuracy and completeness of electoral registers, which I'm very happy to say that Ipsos worked on for the Electoral Commission. Phil, would you start us off by just taking us through maybe some of that research and some of the findings?
Yeah, sure. So this is a really big bit of research that the Commission does every 3 or 4 years. We're the only body, I think, that really delves into the quality of the electoral registers in the UK. As you say, Ipsos carried out the fieldwork for us this time. So it's a large sort of house-to-house study, really robust findings. In terms of the headlines from this year, we had 86% of people who were eligible to register to vote in the UK correctly registered. And that was 86% in Great Britain and 83% in Northern Ireland. And levels of accuracy, which are relatively unchanged since the last time that we did this study, the previous one being in 2018.
Mm-hmm. And I think we should probably say that when we talk about the registers now being complete, almost exclusively, not quite, but almost exclusively, this comes from people not being registered to vote when they actually have the right to be on the registers. So it's less linked to errors that would prevent people from voting. It's more...
Yes, and I think it's maybe worth saying we talk about it in terms of completeness and accuracy as two terms. I mean, what we mean, I suppose, by completeness in particular is that if you're entitled to register, you're eligible to vote in the UK, then you're on the register, and crucially, you're on the register at the correct address. So you're where you live at the moment, if your polling station, you know, is down the street, and not at a previous address where, you know, if an election came around, you'd be very unlikely to be able to vote because you would be, you know, maybe a few streets away, maybe in a different local authority, and, you know, you wouldn't be able to go and cast a vote.
And how has that changed since the last time that we measured this?
I mean, the long-term trend is one of decline. So there have been studies looking at completeness and accuracy, completeness in particular, really since the 50s, when you got really high levels of completeness, so 96, 95%. That sort of declined quite steadily over time. Around about 2001, the commission, when it was set up, started doing this type of research. It found then that there was sort of 92% of people correctly registered. That then dropped quite a lot into 2011, down to the high 80s. And really since then, we've carried out a number of studies in the 2000s. And since then, it's kind of held around the mid 80s. So this year was 86%. In 2018, when we did the previous study, it was 83%. So it's been quite stable over the recent past, but that represents a drop in kind of historic terms.
Because I guess when you first look at the data, the initial impression is to think, well, it's not worse. Maybe it's even got a tiny bit better. But actually, we should keep in mind that that is a lot of people who are not on the registers. We estimated that at the UK level, up to 8 million people could be missing from the registers. I guess my question is, and not to get too leading, but do we care about that? Does that matter in any way? If people don't want to vote, why do we want them to be on the registers? Or is that what's happening?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair question. I think one way in which it matters less which I think sometimes people think about, is to do with boundaries. So we're not in this research saying that those 8 million people are not somewhere on an electoral register and represented in some way. They may be there at a previous address. So in terms of drawing constituency boundaries and other things, I don't think that is the main issue. The issue really is they may want to vote or not want to vote, but if they're not registered, then they can't make that choice when an election comes around. And in a lot of cases, and we've seen in recent history, general elections can come around quite quickly and maybe a bit unexpectedly. And if you decide suddenly that you do want to vote and you're not on the register, then that's going to be a problem. And in particular, it puts the more people who aren't there in generally, it puts more pressure on the people that manage electoral registers, which is not the Electoral Commission, but is local authorities and electoral registration officers. And before the 2019 election, general election, we saw something in the region of 3.9 million applications to register in that sort of 5-6 week period, 660,000 on the last day before the deadline. And that's a huge amount of applications for those teams to process when they're also setting up and running the election itself.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing to keep in mind is their list of tasks, the workload that we've placed on people administering elections is ever increasing, as we have a lot more requirements now with voter ID, processing new applications for postal votes. That all adds up. And I think some of the research that you've commissioned or others have put out in the academic sector shows that actually those members of staff are actually quite pressured.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gets called a no-fail service. And yeah, you're absolutely right. There are increasing complexities to it and requirements. You mentioned voter ID, things around postal votes, expansions of franchise to overseas voters at the next general election. And the more we could do to reduce the sort of pressure that comes from the registration side, the better.
Alan, I was wondering, as sort of coming from the outside of this research, has anything caught your eye in some of the results that we've presented?
Yeah, and also on your kind of last question to Phil as well, it matters because of the scale, but also because there are particular demographics that again and again and again are not on the register mm-hmm. in large numbers. And what was quite interesting from this research, when you compare it to the last in 2018, was that while some groups have gone up slightly, still not high enough, but for example, the white population, it's slightly higher levels of registration. For the Black community, that's gone down 3%. And I don't know that we know why that is, but that's obviously a concern because people from minoritized ethnicities, migrants, young people, people that rent their homes, especially those that do it privately, and people from low income backgrounds are much less likely to vote, which means that they're not being heard election after an election. So it's an equalities issue as well as a scale problem. And we know that people turn up on polling day trying to vote and they're turned away by local authorities. Most local authorities report that happens. So it's not necessarily that people don't want to vote. Some people may not be aware of their right to vote, particularly certain migrant communities. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we don't necessarily talk about apathy because that might ignore some of the genuine barriers for people taking part.
And is there any, I guess you and at UK Democracy Fund, you've done quite a lot of work in this area. Do we know what can we do to convince people to vote from your point of view? How do we get them on those registers?
This is a very, very important question. I think the first thing to acknowledge is that the barriers will be different depending on who you are. And the first thing you have to do is understand why people aren't voting. So for people who rent their homes, for example, it's relatively easy to interpret, especially from the Electoral Commission data around the length that you've lived in your home. So I think I've got the stats somewhere, but if you've lived in your home for less than a year, it's like 39% or something registered. And it skyrockets up to above 70%, up to above 90% if you've been in your home longer. And we can probably all relate to that because if you move house, it's probably not the first thing you do to register to vote. You've probably got to start your council tax. Getting your internet set up is a nightmare. Maybe you've got to move your children's school and a GP and all your bills and all that kind of thing. If you're moving house really regularly, some people move multiple times a year, is it realistic that that's going to be your main priority? So the kind of the kind of practical need to actually do your own registration each time you move is itself a barrier. For other people, it could be knowledge about their voting rights. So if you're a citizen of a Commonwealth country, but you're resident in the UK, you are entitled to vote, but they don't vote in high rates. So probably because no one considers themselves a Commonwealth citizen. But if you think about the countries we're talking about, if you're from India, Nigeria, Pakistan, Jamaica, Malaysia, this is large numbers of people. They have the right to the vote in the UK if they're resident here without needing UK nationality. But you know, that information isn't necessarily well known, as well as kind of other things about literally how you register and how you take part and things like that. There are other barriers, maybe psychological ones as well. So some evidence from things that we funded in the past with young people who've, you know, there's franchise extension happened in like Wales and Scotland for 16 and 17 year olds for like local and devolved elections. And there's some evidence that younger people tend to feel that they don't have the knowledge or the insight to be able to take part, which of course is not a requirement. No one else is required to demonstrate that they, you know, that they know enough about politics or politicians to be allowed to take part. So actually encouraging people that, you know, explaining to them how they can take part and, you know, building in, for example, good quality democratic education alongside, you know, working with people when they are still in institutions like schools and colleges can be really important, which is why it's quite concerning the really low rate of registration for attainers, which is what we call 16 and 17 year olds, who are not necessarily eligible to vote right now, but could turn 18 by the time of the next general election. So it's important that they're kind of on the register, but they've got incredibly low rates of registration.
Yeah, and those have been, sorry, just in pick some of the things that you've covered, which is quite a lot. Some of those trends amongst attainers in particular are quite worrying, because the levels of registration amongst 16 and 17 year olds who are eligible to be on the registers, who will be eligible to vote at the next election, levels of registration have really gone down. And it sort of, it reminds me of other work from the Electoral Commission that I'd seen, where it cautioned, I think, when the new changes had come in to how the annual canvass is being done in Britain, I think the Electoral Commission flagged the risk of missing out on those attainers. I don't know, Phil, if you want to give a brief description of what the changes have been and how that might impact.
Yeah, and I think it is worth saying. I mean, they are a group worth focusing on, because unlike a lot of the other groups where people are under-registered, and they have been consistently, and that's important, the attainer numbers, I mean, really have dropped, and they're the one group probably where that is the case. It's a really consistent downward trend. I mean, there's two things, I think. One is when the UK changed its registration system from a household one to an individual one, where each person sort of had to put themselves on the register, that had an impact on attainers, I think probably largely for the motivational reason that as someone who can't vote immediately, there's less motivation for you to do it yourself, where previously someone in your household could have put your name on. And then in 2019, there was a change to how the annual canvassing process works. So the process where local authorities, you know, try and refresh their registers and go house to house and knock on doors. And in that case, in an effort to do as much or as effective a canvassing process, but with less resource, they effectively used a data matching process where in comparing the registers with national government data, they said, well, it looks like there's been no changes at this household, for example. So it's fine. We can send them a letter. We'll tell them who we have registered. If there have been changes, they can get in touch, but we won't sort of chase them for responses. And obviously, if you have someone in your household who was 15 last year, is 16, 17 this year, you would get one of those letters saying, it looks like nothing's changed, when obviously something has changed. And I think that, again, has contributed to what was already a downward trend from the individual registration change. So I think when we did a complete inaccuracy study back in 2014, maybe, in England, I think you had about half of 16, 17 year olds as attainers registered, and it's now 16%. So it's really, you know, it's really low. And I suppose maybe for this group more than any other, there's a kind of why does it matter question, because they can't vote immediately. But I think it's back to the point that that you made before. If an election comes around, they may want to vote. And also with voting as habit forming, it's even more habit forming potentially the first time you do it. So in those scenarios where someone is 17, there's an election, they're suddenly 18, they're not registered, they can't vote, might be 5 years to the next election. So there's almost, if not more importance, but there is a significance to making sure that that barrier of them not being on there, you know, is removed.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a time in your life when so many things could be changing. A lot of people do move out of their parents' homes. And if they haven't formed that habit yet, it's very unlikely that they will on their own when they're away from that, what we would call, I think, a positive influence from their parents registering them to vote. And actually, I think it comes back to something you had mentioned, Ellen, about renters as well, people who are renting, who move house fairly often. We also see quite low levels of registration amongst that group. And it's quite, what I find quite worrying is that group is increasing. We have more and more renters out there, and they tend to be older from my understanding. They seem to be renting for longer. So then is there a risk that we will have a generational effect where this group that maybe previously at some point would have settled down and registered once and then maybe not have to worry about it for a long time, is that then just going to mean that we'll have this generation that is just less likely to be registered and ultimately vote?
It's really important because the overlap between people who rent their home and all the other demographics we talked about who are low voting is obviously huge. You know, it's completely intersected. There's a new report out by Generation Rent, and it's talking about the rise in rental population and low voting rates. And I think they say about 20% of the UK now are private renters. So it's a really, really significant number, and it's grown a lot. It's gone up, I think, 29% in 10 years or something like that. So it's a lot. And the point is if you're consistently in that, you know, regularly, you know, having to move home, as you said, if you live somewhere for years, you register once and you're voting in election after election, so you're heard consistently. And that's not necessarily true if you're moving house very frequently, and particularly for people who live in homes of multiple occupancy. And that's something that came up in your data as well. The kind of, I think it's particularly the accuracy is complete, is much harder to get right.
Yeah, I think in homes, particularly where you've got changes within, you know, residents, not everyone's leaving and moving at the same time. I think that exacerbates the problem even more.
Exactly, and where people might not actually know the people they live with that well in order to be able to provide that information. That's quite interesting. I'm wondering, Ellen, if there's anything else that from your work that sort of helps sort of bring all of this to life.
Yeah, I mean, so you kind of asked earlier about what we know works. And as I say, it kind of depends on who you're talking about. But there's probably the main thing which we think is the most effective from things we've either funded or, you know, research and things like that is again and again, it's face-to-face interaction where you've already got a trusted relationship. So if you're thinking about running a voter registration campaign, you want to identify who your demographic is and understand who they already trust, where there is already a relationship. And that could be with, you know, a local community leader, you know, faith organizer. It could be in a school, it could be teacher or college, things like that. It could be an institution. So we try and build that in and sort of make use of that through the different things that we fund. So for example, we recently funded some pilot campaigns that were run by South Asian diaspora community organizations that were very small, based on focus on really trying to learn more, because this area is not very well researched. There's not lots and lots of information about why people aren't voting and what works. So three organizations who were running registration campaigns in their local area to learn about, you know, to test different things that worked. And it you know, it just demonstrated how important it can be at a local level where you've already got those relationships. And we're funding now some similar, but, you know, quite different, but again, like small local campaigns, focusing on the Black community by Black-led organizations. So that's sort of one end of the scale, but we're also trying to reach such large numbers. And this kind of really targeted local face-to-face work is really expensive. And you're probably not going to get 8 million people on the register like that. We wouldn't, you know, be able to afford to do that for even our 1 million target. So we're looking at what other things we can do to leverage, you know, trusted relationships with institutions, for example. We've funded a campaign by Citizens UK, who are going to be running an accredited, basically, voter champion campaign. So if there are any institutions out there that would like to take part, we'd encourage you to have a look at their at the website, and we can maybe give you the website address. But the idea is that whatever kind of organization you are, if it's a brand or a company or employer, a college and a school, a faith institution, community group, that you can take action to get the people that you interact with registered, you know, bringing voter ID and taking part on election day. And that, so it's sort of trying to identify the, yeah, the, where people already engage and where there is already trust and building on that.
And that's, I think, quite interesting where you bring up that there is a, we do a lot of communications research. I've done some of it myself, and we know that there will be these big channels, like just the telly, ads on the telly, who reach a lot of people, but it is such a crowded environment. It's so difficult to get people's attention. And then some of these groups that we've identified would tend to be young, tend to move around a lot. They're actually even more difficult to reach by through these traditional channels. I think work from grassroots organizations is really important, especially if we're talking about some groups that maybe don't have such high levels of trust in institutions, in the state in general, and it's quite challenging, I think, to get them to really engage and just trust that their voices could be heard and they have a right to vote.
And I think sometimes there's a factor of how people even identify as a voter or not. And that's why some of the messaging is quite important. But there isn't really a lot of clarity of this messaging always works. And I think you just have to test things and try and be willing to adapt.
I mean, it's a very similar story for the commission. I mean, we do a lot of large-scale public awareness activity, whether that's about encouraging people to register to vote or it's about raising awareness about the need to bring ID to vote. But that's always supplemented by both partnership working, so some of the types of stuff that Ellen was talking about where you want individual organizations to really access groups of people that kind of mass market public awareness won't get at, or even, you know, educational stuff through schools. So the commission now does a lot of work with schools around developing educational resources to, you know, to, I suppose, get in early and get kids thinking about this type of thing at a young age.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the other way that we could look at this is maybe a top to bottom approach where we actually look at how the system functions, not just people's motivations, which we do understand some things about, but not, as you said, not a lot. There's not that much research out there. But I think the Electoral Commission has made some suggestions with how the system can be improved. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes, I would. So, yeah, the Commission has had a sort of policy recommendation for quite a while now around the need to really look at more automated ways of getting people registered to vote. So that could be all the way through to fully automatic registration, where citizens don't really need to do anything. They will be put on an electoral register and then they'll be able to vote. Or it could be more targeted, automated types of registration. So we were talking about attainers earlier on. Attainers are the group with maybe the biggest, you know, need in terms of not being registered, but they're also the group where there might be the biggest opportunity, because they're already a group of people who the state, if you like, is in touch with. They before someone turns 16, they get sent a national insurance number. So there is already that process of knowing who someone is, where they are, sending them that number, which is also the number we currently use as an identifier to make sure that someone is who they say they are when they want to register to vote. So there's a process there, I think, that we think could be used in order to increase the registration of attainers. But there's lots of other ways that you might look at that more joined up data sharing approach. We talked about private renters. There are things around tenancy deposit schemes where the details of private renters are held as part of those deposit schemes. That data, if it could be accessed by electoral registration officers, could be used to put those people on the register, or at the very least to be in touch with them in a more direct way to invite them to register. So there's just lots of opportunities to move in that more automated direction, I think.
And that does sound like a massive work program. Would it be essentially a lot of different agencies and the departments sharing data? Just
depending on exactly what it looked like, yeah, it could be a variety of data sources. I mean, alongside the results of the Accuracy and Completeness research, we also published some feasibility studies looking at some of the types of examples of this and how it would work, the types of things that would need to be done to move us from where we are now to that working in practice. I mean, I think the headline finding there was it's all very doable, but there would be things that you would need to do in order to, you know, securely move data around, ensure it was held in the right way, all that kind of thing. But it's all very manageable. And the data, crucially, already exists. You wouldn't be creating any kind of new databases necessarily.
It would be just linking data, making sure it gets updated when it there's a need for it. Interesting. And I think there's been some research, as much as you can make international comparisons on these issues, I think there's been some research that suggests that countries that do have automatic voter registration or some sort of form of it do tend to have more accurate registers as well.
Yeah, there's lots of international examples of people doing it along a spectrum, like we said, but yeah, that it has a positive impact. And in particular, it deals with that point of putting people on the register maybe who aren't not registered because of any motivational reason. They just happen to not be. Maybe they haven't got around to it, they've forgotten about it, they didn't realize, but they're perfectly keen to vote. And some of this would remove, you know, that group of people from the group of people who aren't registered, and to some extent would let you focus efforts on maybe some of the people who do need, you know, more convincing or more information, or that, you know, that side of the coin.
Mm-hmm. And is there a risk when you do this that actually some groups are even more likely to be ignored, to be left behind, because the wider system doesn't necessarily see them or is able to really accurately identify them?
I think you would. That would definitely be something that I think would need to be looked at as part of, you know, what data sources were you going to use and what does the system as a whole look like? You know, if the only route to becoming registered was by being on another database somewhere else, then I think that would have some definite potential implications. But I think there are so many bits of data, and you could still then obviously have the system whereby you're also encouraging people in other ways to register to vote and raising awareness, that hopefully that, you know, that wouldn't be a problem.
Sort of signposting them when they access different services, or
if they apply for a driving license or a passport, or they change their address on their driving license, for example, you know, any of those sort of transactions with the state where you're already doing something these days quite often entirely online, so you're not having to, you know, you're already providing all the information, and it could be shared with electoral registration officers.
Wonder, Ellen, have you done any sort of, have you looked into this at all?
Yeah, we have. And I would agree that it's really, really important. And inevitably, there probably would be some people who would, there would still be a need for the kinds of campaigns that we fund to make sure that people weren't being neglected. But you're not going to close that 8 million gap with the kinds of campaigns we're running, really, because it's there's just not the resource there for it. You know, as I say, the kind of really effective things that work for the kinds of groups that are, you know, very unlikely to, you know, register and vote at high levels. We know we've done quite a lot to demonstrate what's effective, and we'll continue to learn about that and do research on it. And it can be really, really impactful. But nobody's got the money to do that, to get 8 million people on the register. So it really all points to making it more automated to actually address that scale issue. And then that would free up local authorities, civil society organizations to target those who are still not being captured much more effectively, and, you know, allow resources to be spent in another way. And the other thing I would say as well is we've also funded a campaign about auto-enrollment at universities, which is another option. So universities are actually, especially in England, I think, required to support their students to register and to vote. And one simple way of doing that is to have data sharing agreements with local authorities, so that every year when your students enroll or re-enroll on the course, they're able to be put on the register. And that's something that can happen now. It doesn't need to bring an automatic voter registration. So, which would be, you know, longer term, I think a more automated system is going to be required. But in the interim, there's still things that can be done.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if we've ever tested this properly, but I think there is some anecdotal evidence, at least, and we do often sometimes hear this when we do qualitative research. Some people do have an expectation that their details will be updated, maybe when they move and they apply for council tax. There is, I think, I don't know how widespread this belief is, but some people do wrongly believe that the council will just update their address everywhere in the system, including on the electoral registers.
Yeah, that's definitely something we've seen in previous research and kind of public opinion polling. And particularly, I think about council tax is a definite one. But even just in other ways, I think there is an expectation or growing expectation that when you're interacting with the public sector in some way, that data is being kind of used in a efficient way. And obviously, there will be other people who would have concerns about giving their data in and it being used in other ways. So there's lots of ways in which you would need to manage the process and explain the process and how it works. But yeah, I think the balance is that it's easier for people. And as long as they trust how you're handling the data and using it, then it's a positive.
It is interesting you say that, because it does remind me of some, we work on a series called State of the State, and we actually ask the respondents how they feel about, how they trust different levels of government handle personal data. I think, unfortunately, there's not a very high level of trust in the UK government, the central government, handling personal data. But I think what we find is often local government is more trusted handle personal data. And this would mostly be happening at a local level, activities that you're suggesting.
Yeah, I mean, electoral registration officers, you know, are based in local authorities in England, Wales. And yeah, it would be them accessing that data or having that data passed to them and then using it for registration purposes.
Yeah, I imagine you haven't yet done research into or looked into how we can increase people's trust in how we handle their data at local level. Is that the next step?
I think it would be not in any detail. I think one of the interesting questions is, well, it's probably true of any type of research, but when you want to find out that kind of level of detail, I think we'd need to know more about what the proposal was, and then you could test that out a little bit. So it'd be, I think it'd be quite different if it was, you know, only that issue around attainers and people being given their national insurance number versus if everyone who had a driving license in the UK, if that was being brought into play. So I think you would want to understand how the public would react to it, and that is something that we could certainly do through future bits of research.
And I guess we will have the opportunity to see how that works in Wales. I think there is legislation. I don't think it's passed yet, but I imagine we're expecting it to pass. That is bringing in automatic voter registration in Wales. So there's quite interesting how the systems are diverging between the different nations. And I imagine there will be a lot of testing to see how that works.
I think in Wales in particular, that they're proposing to pilot, so to do some of those tests rather than to bring something in. But yeah, there would be a challenge around that working for people being registered for some elections and not for others, because obviously some are devolved and some aren't. But it would be a really interesting test, and it may well, you know, show the way and highlight some issues that could be solved ahead of it being maybe picked up at the UK level.
And Unlock Democracy have just released a new report about automatic voter registration. So people can have a look at that.
Absolutely. I think there have been increasing calls from some sectors of some areas of civil society asking for automatic voter registration or some sort of form of automated or supported registration, I guess. So it would be interesting to see if we do move into that direction. Was there anything else you thought would be worth mentioning from the research or from your wider research, actually?
I think... I guess maybe another point on the kind of more automated system is there's some research which we funded in the past. It's on our website by Sobolesca and Barclay, talking about people from minority ethnic backgrounds and migrants and voting rates in the UK and various interesting bits of information about why people are and aren't voting. But one particular piece that was really interesting was talking about, whilst there is quite a significant difference between registration rates of the white population and other ethnic groups, when it comes to once registration is taken out of the way, the voting rates are actually not that different. Mm-hmm. So it's another factor to consider when thinking about a more automated system, is not only can it help achieve that scale and accuracy, but it can also undercut some of the equality challenges as well. So I think that's something that's worth bearing in mind.
Yeah, definitely. And also we shouldn't forget that being on the electoral register does help with your credit score as well. And I wonder, is that even more inequality that we are introducing into the system by not really having the same levels of registration across different groups? Is that the difference between someone being able to afford a good, advantageous loan versus something that's possibly more detrimental to their personal finances? So there are wider benefits outside of voting.
Yeah, I mean, it is used for those purposes. And if you happen to not be registered, it can be a problem from that side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Shall we end maybe on actually a positive note? Because I think some of our conversations have been quite, not sure if that optimistic, but Northern Ireland has been an excellent positive case study. Do you want to tell us about what's happened in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, so Northern Ireland has a slightly different system of registration to the rest of Great Britain. So there are no annual canvasses in Northern Ireland. And it has a system of what was called continuous registration. So the electoral office there maintains the register by accessing data sources. It's not automatic registration. They have to get information and then write out to people, invite them to register. We've done studies in Northern Ireland since 2012, and we've found effectively kind of cycles of low levels of completeness, and then the chief electoral officer in Northern Ireland is able to recommend that a canvass happens. So it doesn't happen every year, but he's able to recommend that one happens. And we did a study in 2012. It found quite low levels of registration, so sort of low 70%. There was a canvass in 2013. It shot up. Or in our previous study in Northern Ireland in 2018, again, it was relatively low compared to Great Britain. Again, there was a canvass in 2021, and this time we've seen a big increase. So I think between 2018 and our 2022 study, it was up by 10 percentage points in Northern Ireland. So really, you know, really positive. And actually, the levels between Great Britain and Northern Ireland are now very similar. So it is a good news story. I suppose it does come back round to the point about automatic registration, in the sense that you do keep needing to do those canvasses, which are quite resource intensive. And also they risk, you know, periods in between the canvasses where it's sort of steadily declining. So I think in a way it's quite neat in the sense that it's got there in slightly different ways, but the two places are kind of telling us the same thing about what the future kind of policy might be.
Yeah, it's an interesting example. I think shows perfectly how efficient those in-person interventions can be, but also that they're actually quite costly, very difficult to manage. And there could be, obviously Northern Ireland has a lot of context and history that we do need to be mindful of, but it does show that actually it is quite difficult to do these in-person interventions, but they can be efficient.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, they're very effective in Great Britain as well. But it is that point about sustainability, I think. And back to what we were talking about at the start about all the other things that these people are having to do in order to run elections and get people registered to vote. And if you can take some of that effort out, I think, and maybe even make it better, then that feels like a good place to aim for.
But yeah, just to add a positive point, there is lots of really great work going on. Loads of, you know, lots of people that we work with in civil society, but, you know, also beyond that. And there are lots of resources out there that people interested in getting involved can find out more. So, for example, Democracy Classroom is a really good resource. It's a website hub where lots of different organisations have shared resources, particularly focused on young people. But, you know, I think anyone who wanted to do anything around voter registration would find it useful. And there's trainings, things like that available. There are lots of really exciting campaigns that I think will be happening in the run-up to the election. So hopefully we will be able to get lots and lots of people registered.
Well, I think then let's end it on that very, very positive note. Thank you so much for joining me for that very interesting conversation. And hopefully we will see increased levels of registration soon. And thank you very much for all of you for listening. If you enjoyed that podcast, if you want to hear more about what we do here at Ipsos, some of our polling, please do make sure that you subscribe wherever subscriptions are a thing and follow our podcast wherever podcasts are a thing. Thank you very much and have a nice day.